Good morning.
You're listening to too much
scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for November 2nd, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm candidate number two. Vote for me.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Would that make you candidate number three, Pam?
I guess it would.
As of this moment, I am putting my hat in the ring. I'm the only one wearing a hat, so I will run this election fairly and equally. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. How you doing, Pam?
Oh, great. It's great to be with you guys.
Great to have you back. 2 weeks in a row, our monthly visit with Pam Bedore. We cheated and had one in October and one in November. So we'll see how much time can pass before we can get Pam back on the show after this. But you're here because it's still spooky season. It's still time for a little more monster talk. And since we loved your monster conversation about werewolves last week, we had to have you back to talk about vampires. Chip, you're here to talk about voting rights, right?
It's all about voting, Steve. You got to pick your right candidate, and I've got the right values here. Vote for me.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Oh my, Pam, young. Happy Pam, you got to see a fresh new movie in a movie theater this week.
It was pretty exciting. So this is a movie. It was just released yesterday, and I saw it on the day it was released. My Hero Academia, World Heroes Mission. Now, this is the third movie in a series, and my two kids love this series, and so do all of their friends. And it was so funny. I'd never watched anything from this. There's a TV series as well as some movies. And I recognized all the characters from all the merchandise that's around my home and all the costumes that I've seen the kids wear at various events. So this was great. It's in Japanese, filmed in Japanese. The theater I went to was showing it with subtitles instead of dubs. Some of the subtitles were kind of hilarious, hilariously translated, which is always fun. But the story was really great. It's a superhero story, apocalyptic, supervillain superheroes. This was a lot of fun, and my kids loved it.
It hits all the genres. It is anime, which Steve loves, and then also it's a reading movie. So you gotta test yourself a little bit.
My Hero Academia is certainly popular. Pam is right. I know this. I don't know the story as such, but I do know this product because my students love My Hero Academia. This is a very popular anime right now.
Absolutely. And you guys, my first time ever going to a movie theater with heated seats.
Oh, Pam, that
it
sounds...
It was a very comfortable experience.
That sounds like the most expensive nap I will ever put for. That is one of my problems with theaters nowadays, is I am an old man, and I don't know how many old men you know, but when I sit down, there's a very good chance I will be asleep within minutes. And if there's a movie on and there's heated seats, comfortable, nice heated seats, I'm going to fall asleep and I'm going to miss part of this movie.
But you'll still be able to catch up because it does follow all of the tropes of superhero movies.
But in a good way, right?
In a really good way. Yeah, it was excellent. The characters were a lot of fun. There were some really interesting social critiques, for sure. Hmm. And definitely recommending the third installation of the My Hero Academia movie franchise.
Would you recommend it to somebody who has not seen much of this material because it is pretty straightforward?
Yes. And it was funny because my kids said, "Mom, you're not going to understand anything. You don't know anything." And, you know, they're so right in so many ways when it comes to me not understanding. But honestly, these are familiar tropes. It's really playing with all of the apocalyptic and superhero tropes that we're so familiar with, but in a really fun way.
That's I will take that as a stellar endorsement from the mom of the group taking the kids to go see a movie. Chip, you saw a movie that might seem familiar as well, right?
Well, I saw a series, and it's called The Lost Symbol. Some of you know it from Dan Brown, and it's on streaming on Peacock. They gave you the first three episodes, and then they're releasing the remaining episodes weekly, so you'll get the another part every week. But this one, I'll be honest with you, this stars Robert Langdon, but he doesn't look anything like Tom Hanks.
So that was gonna be my first question. This is Robert Langdon. Do you identify this character, even though it's a different actor? Is this Robert Langdon in this series?
Yeah, I kind of wish that this is how The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons would have been released. It would have been a more enjoyable experience than the Ron Howard, Tom Hanks movies, which kind of hit and miss a little bit. We should know Dan Brown. Dan Brown's writes about the hidden mysteries of life, and there's always some kind of underlying conspiracy of it. It's fun. You're dealing with a symbologist who is a Harvard professor. This is a lot of fun. Like the Dan Brown books, just don't think too deeply and kind of go for the ride. I enjoyed this. It's on streaming on Peacock. I think many people would enjoy this.
Cam, are you a fan of the Dan Brown puzzle mysteries?
I certainly am. It's been a long time, though. I mean, I read them as they came out, and I feel like I probably read the first two or three. How many are there now? I might have lost track.
I have definitely lost track.
Okay. So I definitely remember Angels and Demons. I'm not sure about the third, but anyway, these were fun.
The Da Vinci Code was, of course, the one that hit big. That was exactly. That was his big hit. And I really enjoyed that book. I did not enjoy that movie. I agree with you, Chip, that if we had the release schedule to make that into a series, I think that would have been a much better film. There's something about taking a whole book with all the fun twists and all the fun puzzles and making it into a two-hour event that it missed the mark for me a little bit.
Well, I think they could remake those as a series, assuming that The Lost Symbol does well. Once again, it's streaming on Peacock, which is NBC's streaming app, and you can watch it there.
There you go. You also got a chance to see Free Guy, which was one of my suggestions for 2021. This is a super fun video game made into a movie. Did you enjoy Free Guy?
I did. I think, in fact, they've already gave a green light to a second part of this. This, of course, stars Deadpool as a character in a video game. And it is totally the Deadpool character right there, Steve.
It is not exactly the Deadpool character, but it's certainly got that same cheeky comedy feel to it.
Yep, and I'll say 75 out of 100. So if you wanted to know whether it's a good movie, this is a teen movie and up and very good. And I think that during the holiday season, if you're looking for something to watch, this would be the type thing you'd throw on.
That's
very good.
Great recommendation. Pam, have you seen this one?
I haven't, but I will. I saw the trailer and I thought, oh, you can see exactly what this is going to be. I will totally enjoy it.
Steve, do you have any movies that star Odin's son?
Yes, there's a movie starring Thor Odin's son, and it is a movie. Okay, this is a long story, but long story short, I watched Cabin in the Woods this week from 2011. This is a 10-year-old film. This is a horror film that for 10 years people have told me, oh, Steve, you need to watch this movie. And I've said for 10 years, no, I don't like horror movies. I'm not going to watch this. And the people whom I've spoken to said, no, Steve, you need to watch this. The problem with Cabin in the Woods is I can't tell you why it's good. This movie has such a different take on the horror movie genre that those of you who enjoy the movies that I enjoy, Ash versus Evil Dead, the any kind of comedy horror that you've enjoyed, you should watch Cabin in the Woods. The interesting twist, this was written by Joss Whedon, so anything that
guy from Buffy Vampire Slayer? I don't know anybody who likes that.
So Pam, have you watched Cabin in the Woods? Have you seen this movie?
No, but I am totally intrigued by your recommendation. And like, you had me at Joss Whedon, so there we go.
Pam, you should watch Cabin in the Woods because it's different from the horror movie. It takes all the tropes of the horror movie and turns them on their ear, not like Scream. It's not Scream, but it kind of is. It's not Tucker and Dale versus Evil, but it's kind of like that one too. So I'm not going to break this movie, but I'm telling you, Pam, you need to watch Cabin in the Woods.
All right. Well, thank you. And that makes me think of a few like animal movies that break the horror genre. So I don't know if you guys have seen Black Sheep or Zombiever or Lamageddon. I mean, these are all films that are very fine, high quality takes on the horror movie genre as well. These are the worst films, but so much fun.
Chip, do you remember when Zombievers was released?
And I do remember it. And the scene that got the name, Zombievers.
I also watched all of my annual Halloween favorites this week because happy Halloween, everyone. I hope everyone had a great time trick-or-treating on Sunday. I watched Young Frankenstein because I have it every year. It is good, isn't it? You made a yummy noise. Rocky Horror Picture Show is one of those things that I just have to watch every year. The Nightmare Before Christmas is a classic. Ash versus Evil Dead, I went back and watched all of season one this week, and I watched The Muppet Haunted Mansion a fourth time this week. That movie is a genuine going on my list of annual watches. It's just golden. Opening this week, we've got, hey, Chip, remember when they made the movie The Eternals and they released it to theaters? No, you don't, because it's releasing this week, even though they filmed it, 2 years ago?
Well, COVID certainly changed a lot of this. This is Marvel's The Eternals, so if you're a person who likes the MCU, this is a move forward, I guess, is we're going to learn about the Deviants. We're going to learn about the Eternals and sort of how they relate to the Marvel Universe. It should be good. It stars a person from Game of Thrones.
And the British people of us that we are now, that we have 18 stars that go into all of these movies. Yes, you will recognize a lot of the faces in this movie. This is a story about immortal beings from Earth from long throughout history, right?
It's based on Jack Kirby's work from the 1970s when he came back from DC after he left Marvel. Okay. Jack Kirby, for those who do not know, was the person who created most of the Marvel Universe that you're well aware of, Fantastic Four and the Avengers and all those characters. But he left and came back and decided he was going to make something sort of the zeitgeist of the time. This is kind of Chariots of the God-ish. Anyway, it's now part of the Marvel Universe, and they're going to dig deep and see how it fits into the great mythology that is the Marvel Universe.
Right. We've got
Steve, are there any movies to star Forrest Gump?
I was thinking more Castaway than Forrest Gump. There's a movie.
Fire! I made fire.
Fire good. No, that's a different movie. Finch is coming to our Apple TV service this week. This is Tom Hanks all on his own by himself with a volleyball. Nope. I take that back. It's not a volleyball. It's a robot that the Tom Hanks character made.
And he also, Steve, has Hooch in this movie. I was wondering what happened to him.
Oh, this is Castaway and Hooch, the post-apocalyptic.
So this is a story of the world has somehow come to an end. Tom Hanks' character is kind of working its way through this desolate world, finds a dog, and he wants to build a robot. So we're going to learn a little bit about that. There's a storm coming, Steve, and this movie was going to talk about this experience. What can you say?
Pam, it's post-apocalyptic. Is this a movie that you're excited about? Good answer. It seems like to me like there's too many concepts in there. Like maybe this will be really good, but it seems like there's too many things to keep track of there. We'll see. Speaking of trying to keep track of things, there's a movie called Spencer that's coming out this week, and it's
are not, there any vampires in this one, Steve?
It's not Spencer for Hire. This is the story of Princess Diana when she decides to leave her marriage to Prince Charles, and Princess Diana is played here by Line,
the Totino's sports person.
Line, Kristen Stewart, my least favorite actor working today. I have zero expectations for Kristen Stewart films, but the reviews on this one say she does a great Diana impression. Pam, are you excited for a Princess Diana movie? That's two for two on Pam. Chip, do you
Steve, there's probably something that she does want to see, and it's probably something French. Is there any French movie? Are there any French movies in this list?
Yes, there is a movie called Anonymous Animals that is reaching American shores from our French friends this week. This is an award-winning, very interesting-looking story about something with animals. There's a deer with a shotgun. That's what I saw in the trailer.
This is Planet of the Apes with deer, Steve.
I would watch the heck out of Planet of the Deer.
Wow. Okay.
Get your hooves off of me, you darn dirty fawn.
The animals have taken over with their human forms.
That sounds interesting.
Wasn't Planet of the Apes written by a French writer too? I mean, what is it with the French and their love of humanoid animals? But anyway, there's a movie coming out this week called Anonymous Animals. Go find it.
Book it.
Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. Pam, you came back 2 weeks in a row. We talked about werewolves last week, and we had to have equal time. When we talk about werewolves, we need to talk about vampires. So you came back this week to discuss Fledgling. This is by Octavia Butler. It was published in 2005. Pam, you have been trying to get us to read Octavia Butler for years. Thank you for bringing us this book this week.
Did you like it?
I liked it very much. I liked it very much. Vampires are definitely my genre, and Octavia Butler's writing style, I see why you enjoy her voice now that I've read Fledgling.
Oh, I'm so excited, because as you guys may know, Octavia Butler is one of my all-time favorite writers. I absolutely love all of her work. She only published 13 novels.
Only published.
No, you're right to say that, Jim. I mean, her output, each of those novels is so interesting in its own way. She really wrote about through many of my favorite subgenres in science fiction. She's got her alien novels, her telepathy novels, her time travel novel, her post-apocalyptic novels, and now Fledgling was her vampire novel. But she died really suddenly and unexpectedly at age 58. And I still remember where I was when my friend Esther in grad school came and said, Pam, did you hear? And I was like, I just saw her face and I was like, what? And she said Octavia Butler had died. And it was just one of those writer deaths that really, really hit me hard, partly because she's someone I admire so much, but also, and I hate to say this, but like two of her series were in progress. And so, I mean, she wrote these incredible stories and the thought that they will never be finished. Oh, it's devastating. In addition to just the sadness of losing such a wonderful human being.
So this winds up being her final published novel.
That's right.
This was the last one. So we're reading Octavia Butler for the first time, and it's such a rich story. And I understand how you feel like, oh, we're going to miss, as a society, we're going to miss this voice. We're going to miss this writer so strongly, because this is great writing. Chip, did you enjoy Fledgling?
So I want to address her writing style before I answer that, but I should say that her writing is incredibly accessible. So if you were reading something like Neil Gaiman or a writer that certainly has a very flowery way of writing, sometimes you have to kind of struggle to kind of find out where you are in that moment. With Octavia Butler, it's wonderful. It's very straightforward. You certainly understand where you're standing with this book, and you can just kind of plow through it in a very good way because there's a lot of rich ideas in there.
That is wonderful. You are absolutely right. I had no trouble getting into the story that she was telling here. And she certainly gave us all of the elements that we needed right from the beginning, where we have a young person who is waking up in a cave, not knowing who she is, this amnesia that we as the readers are going along with this character and trying to discover with her who she is. And you're right, it is written in such a wonderful way that I'm not lost any more than I'm supposed to be lost with this character, with this amnesia.
And it's interesting because Butler was an African-American science fiction writer, woman, African-American science fiction writer, who started writing in the mid to late 70s. And so she was one of a kind for a long time. Now there are many really exciting Black female writers out there today in the worlds of science fiction and fantasy, but she was really a pioneer in that space. And I'm just really fascinated by the fact that she didn't go to Harvard. Like, she grew up in Southern California. Her mother was a widow, struggled financially, and she was super, super shy. Now, I only met Butler once, but she was amazing. And she was doing a reading, and she has written about her own social anxiety and shyness. And she grew to be 6 feet tall. As she says, she always wanted to disappear. And then she ended up always feeling a little bit uncomfortable as this, you know, tall, very striking woman who just wanted to disappear. And I have to say, when I saw her read, and then I met her when she signed my book, and she was so kind and so lovely, but you knew it took a ton of energy for her to be so generous. So she's just one of these people that I love her accessible writing style. And I always teach her alongside Margaret Atwood and Ursula K. Le Guin, because those are three people whose body of work really captures feminist science fiction of the 70s through today. And students always note, like, wow, those people have this, like Atwood and Le Guin, you know, have this very flowery style, and Butler's just really straightforward. There's no embellishment to the prose. The prose is completely transparent. So you're just in the story. Although all three of these women put together incredible stories. So anyway, sorry, not to wax too poetic, but glad you guys kind of liked this.
Yeah, there's a richness to her writing. It's not that she's not challenging you with ideas. She certainly is. But what's happening is you're not struggling through the words. You're not struggling through a person who is showing off the writing style. Her writing style is like, I can dump information to you in a great way. And now now think about what I just told you.
And we've discussed the info dump. I hate the info dump that some authors have to get this part of the story out to you, the reader. Here it is, bleh. That never happened in this story. She is doling out the information in such an efficient way that you care about this character from the beginning. And I see shadows of that persona that you're telling me about the author in this character. She is a fish out of water trying to make it in this world.
I want to go back to the reader experience, because this book is not for everyone. I could immediately see that by the time you get through the first couple chapters, there's a large percent of our population is going to put it down because it's disturbing. You've got this animalistic, what we think is a child running around naked through, and we're trying to figure out what's going on. And then she has an experience with an adult. And certainly this is part of the challenging part that the reader is going to experience. And you've got to think about this, like, this is just writing. This is something that's going on. And why is it going on And I think that, you know, we're hitting a whole list of taboos that in this story. And like I said, I'm this on a high school shelf, there could be protests.
That's really interesting. I've actually not heard that from students before. Students tend to really love this book. Now, we do talk, I'm so glad you brought up the taboos. And that's something that Butler is really, really interested in, is pushing against meta narratives and asking, like, why are certain things taboo? Why aren't they? She has created here with her vampires, also in the Xenogenesis trilogy with her aliens. She has created like an alternate sexuality as the main modality for these vampire families. And she does something similar with her aliens. And I think she's really asking, by doing that, she's asking, like, are the sexual structures through which we manage our communities, and here we would have to say monogamy, are those the most, are those like natural? Because of course, as mammals, I mean, mammals are not typically monogamous. So humans are sort of, we think of ourselves as monogamous, although the science doesn't always bear that out. And so she's asking, like, she's asking us to question really basic thoughts, really basic concepts about sex and sexuality. So it's interesting, Chip, that, like, as I've taught this book many times, students love that project of challenging our ideas about sexuality. But you're right, some people might not enjoy that.
This is the, you're dealing with college age students who are there in a different way than what we think of as high school. And what I'm really mentioning is these first two chapters, where we don't know the age of this person, but this person looks like a 12-year-old. And there is a scene that is a very sensual scene with an adult. And that certainly is taboo. And this is why, you know, I think that if you were a high school library, a librarian, particularly I'm in the South right now, you know, these are the type of things that they would throw in your face and say, hey, look, how dare you introduce these types of ideas to a young person? I think that once we get past that part and we do learn that this is a vampire and that her age is very, is much greater than that. And also, you know, going on even further than that, I've read Interview with a Vampire by Anne Rice, and we've got another example of a vampire, and they had in the Interview with a Vampire, there was a rule against letting a child become a vampire because you're stuck at that age. That's not the case in Octavia Butler's story, where the vampire grows over time, but the aging is very slow, kind of like for Steve, kind of like Yoda. It's, you know, just want you to let you, you know, describe that for you.
And like Yoda, we have an ageism and a sizeism, where they judge her by her age and they judge her by her size. Oh, judge me by my size, do you? That idea, that idea is prevalent here. And thinking of Octavia Butler, as you said, growing to be 6 feet tall, there's a sizeism there as well. The ageism throughout this story, she is told that she is limited by her age, even though we find out that she has been on this earth for 53 years, she is still very, very young in the vampire community, and she is limited by her experience, and they judge her by that age throughout.
It's like you're talking to Gen Z, Steve.
Mm-hmm. This is a very Gen Z story that was written in 2005. Yeah.
And I'm still thinking about this idea about not carrying Octavia Butler in a library. And I'm just thinking, like, she was the first science fiction writer ever to win the MacArthur Genius Grant.
Listen, you can't have pedophilia in a young person's library. I mean, that's, try to defend that at your local group.
And that's the ageism and sizeism. She looks like a young girl. That is true. She is having a relationship with an older man. That is true. But as we develop this character, we see that she is not out of bounds of the, she is a 53-year-old being in this small body.
Right. So anyway, I'm just fascinated by this idea. I had never even considered censoring Octavia Butler, you know, one of our foremost science fiction writers, but it's an intriguing thought. And I don't know if we should, like, it might be interesting to do some research. I don't know if this book has ever been censored. It's quite possibly the case, Chip. I just hadn't thought of it. So this is why I love doing this podcast, because it never even crossed my mind that Butler could be censored. But of course, I mean, you're making a really good case that some people might want to censor this. When we think about, like, how the vampire functions, because last time we talked a little bit about werewolves. So what do you guys think is the appeal of the vampire in general? As you know, unlike werewolves, who have only a few great tales, vampires, have you've already mentioned the whole Anne Rice world, and we've talked about Buffy earlier. I mean, vampires are everywhere, super, super popular in our society. Why do you think the vampire is so popular?
We should ask the Hungarian.
Yes, let's ask our new segment. Our new segment, Ask the Hungarian. I love the tales of the vampire. I love the idea of living a long, very long life. I love the idea of having a night life, having that childish ideal of being able to go out at night and be free, be open to whatever possibility strikes you at night. That's very different from our day-to-day, go to work 9 to 5, come home, collapse because you're exhausted and you can't have a night life. The sexuality of the vampire is very intriguing. You mentioned Anne Rice. There's so many great stories about the freedom of the sexuality, and maybe it's not sex as we think of it. Maybe it's this sensuality of this way of transferring the spirit from one person to another. And the metaphor there is an almost perfect metaphor for how we communicate with each other when we are physically connected to each other. The vampire has that, where the werewolf is destructive. That's a destructive force. The vampire is building a community, and whatever that means in every story is different for how the community of vampires functions. But there's always that community. The story of What We Do in the Shadows, they have this group of friends that hang out. Oh, and by the way, they're vampires.
That's a movie from 2014.
And a TV show that is currently on some system somewhere on cable, Chip. They made it into a TV show.
So yeah, you guys, when I teach my vampires in literature and culture class, I have so many books to choose from, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there are so many fascinating stories out there. And I think you've hit on all the important things. One thing I would just add to this question about thinking through questions of immortality, of alternate sexualities. The vampire is very attractive to people because it moves beyond strict binaries, right? Because the vampire's sexual organ is the mouth. And so you're not actually stuck like male, female, what are we thinking here? And also questions of procreation. Now, the Ina from Butler's book are quite different. The other thing I would just note is questions of blood. So blood is really cool, right? Because it's that we know, like, if we see blood, it's bad. We're in a horror movie. Like, we should never see the blood that is inside of our bodies. And in vampire shows or stories, we do. But it's also kinship, right? So blood does these two different things at once, and vampires always do. Now, what I think Fledgling does that's super cool is takes a lot of vampire lore, but changes it quite substantially. So Octavia Butler's vampires do not metaphorize contagion. They cannot turn you into a vampire. right? So that's the really, really big difference. I don't know of too many other vampire stories that where humans are not imperiled by the vampire bite. And there's various, you know, various levels of whether they can control who they turn or whatever. But most vampire stories, the vampires can turn humans into vampires. These ones cannot.
But they do have this symbiosis, this exactly. Making humans a part of themselves. The idea of we are one when we have these experiences. We become, in the monogamy, the marriage is one family, and they become family in such a wonderful, beautiful, strong way that when that family's broken, they really struggled with what do we do now?
We're not being specific enough. So one of the agreements that the vampire has with, I guess, the human that they're creating this relationship with is that the human actually request this to continue, because one, it's very pleasurable to have the blood drawn. There is a pleasure that's given from that. And the other part is that the vampire recognizes they have to create a group of people because they will kill a person. They only can draw so much blood over a period of time. So very much like a sexual experience, there's only so much that can be given at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've got to create your, I don't know, group of 5, 6, 7, 8 people to be able to continue make the vampire healthy and also the humans healthy.
And this is something that's so fascinating, this question about the symbionts, which are different, of course, than just turning someone into another vampire. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that my students always bring up, and I don't like to ask it because it seems like a weird question. Would you want to be a symbiont if the Ina existed in our world? It's too personal, but someone in the class always asks it. What do you guys think? Would you do it or not? And I feel like in the novel, Butler provides us with a possible answer. When Shori is talking to one of the symbionts, they say, the whole thing was too weird for me. Worse, I thought it sounded more like slavery than symbiosis, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly right. So like, are the symbionts giving and taking equally with the Ina, or are they sort of slaves to the Ina? And this is a question that always occupies a certain amount of space when I teach this novel, and it's linked to a bigger question. Is Butler thinking of a utopian society here? Are the Ina communities utopian? I mean, the symbionts, they get to live in very good health for a couple hundred years, right? They have this built-in community. They're never lonely. They have a lot of meaningful work, but they cannot leave. So there's no divorcing your Ina. If you end up not happy, you are so biochemically dependent that you cannot leave.
Like a drug. Like a drug. Yeah,
like an addiction, exactly.
Hmm.
And she uses the language of addiction multiple times.
Mm-hmm. And just so we know, the vampire that we follow in the story, while is trying to figure out their life because they've lost their memory,
mm-hmm.
Is very conscious of that. So for her, our vampire that we're following, they want to have an agreement. So, you know, she would be willing to let a victim, a person that she is having this relationship, go until they choose. Now, it's as we get eventually to a trial, we learn that not all vampires are that forgiving or have that as a sort of a conscious offer. But it is something to think about. The vampire lives an incredibly long life, and the human can live, say, for a couple hundred years in good health if they decide they want to create this type of relationship.
And that question of agency then comes up so, so beautifully here. The idea of what decisions you can make in life, the metaphor of these interesting relationships that we don't have in our real life brings up that metaphor of agency. How do we choose our family? How do we choose to live together even when there are things that we don't like about each other? So well put together there.
And the other thing that I think is really fascinating about this novel is how it moves through different genres. It's obviously in the genre of speculative fiction, like everything Butler writes. There are no Ina. However, it also, in the beginning, there's a mystery, like what's happened to Shori's family. Who is she? She doesn't even remember her own name. By the way, I think it's cool that Butler actually doesn't give us her name for like 75 to 100 pages. And so we have this main character whose name we truly don't know for like almost a third of the novel.
And I have to say, I love this thought experiment of what if a vampire had a head injury, and this beautiful idea that they don't die, they will regenerate parts, their brain regenerates, but that pattern of that memory cannot be regenerated. That is gone once this head injury occurs. I went back to that over and over again while I was thinking of this. What are memories? What is that pattern of electricity? And if you have a brain injury, but you're a vampire and your body regenerates, your brain is fine, where are those memories? They're gone. They're fleeting. That's beautiful.
I'm not really interested in that question. I'm more interested in why it happened. Why has this person not have a memory? Mm-hmm. Because to lose a memory is terrible in the sense she's got to figure it out. But the real question is why? What led a being that could last, you know, virtually immortal, mm-hmm. to lose their memory? And that's sort of the discovery that we go through.
And it's such a wonderful mystery, such a wonderful, well laid out mystery where we find out all of the story in such a perfect, no info dump sort of way.
Mm-hmm. So we've got that mystery. And then in the second half, we switch over to a legal proceeding. So it becomes like a legal thriller, except, and this is where I think you can make the argument, two places you can make the argument for utopia. So with the symbiosis, the relationship of symbiosis between Ina and human, that's the kind of utopia that could be like one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. I would never want to do that. Oh, that sounds amazing, right? So both of those things are possible. Now, with the legal system, oh my, didn't it seem so superior to ours? The idea that you wouldn't have all these rules that shield the truth. You would just put people in a room with the oldest, most, you would just choose the elders of your society to represent you in thinking through this legal case. And you would just put the person there and everyone just asks them questions. And then you decide if you believe them or not. You're not, there's no like, you know, there's no evidentiary problems where, you know, something was discovered without a warrant. So you can't use any of that evidence. I mean, this seems very like a very logical way to do a court proceeding.
Because they're vampires and they can sense honesty, because they have that level of supernatural talent to know if somebody is lying or not. That's
they can smell it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't necessarily think that's correct. I think that's a simplistic way of looking at the legal system, assuming that all of a sudden all the wisdom is going to rise to the top. Being old does not mean you're wise.
Right. And I love that she actually addresses that specifically, right? With Milo Silk, who indeed is the eldest he's the eldest person in the space, and he is way too involved. But also since the Ina only lived to be about 400 years, they don't have but I'm saying they don't have the immortality of some vampires. They do have about a 400 year lifespan, and Milo is nearing the end of his life, and he's not very competent. right? And I love that she addresses that. Mm-hmm. And Shuri says, I don't think you're competent. And then they go through and everyone has to state, I do or don't think he's competent. Mm-hmm. And so it's very transparent.
So we get a few other things that are released during that time. One, that we find out that she is a hybrid, that she has been engineered. She can be outside during the daytime, which that vampires cannot. Vampires, the sun
does sparkle. She sparkles in the daytime.
Okay, not cool.
Team Edward, cool. Team Edward. She can stay awake during the day. That means that there's a protection she can offer her partners and the other vampires in the community. That, but regardless, there is, because of she's a hybrid, there is prejudice against her. So once again, we get sort of an addressing of that. The vampires don't consider her pure blood. What can I say?
Mm-hmm.
And she has much darker skin mm-hmm. than most very pale vampires. So there's a lot going, there's a lot to unpack, which is why it's such a pleasure to read and teach this for me, is because you have to think, like, what are the questions about genetic engineering, about hybridization of both genre and beings? What about racism? Like, to what degree is this a question of racism? And then
is racism, course, the proper word for this, though?
Yes. When you,
racism.
Well, yes, there's that. I won't repeat it, but there are the racial epithets that that are said by the symbionts towards Shuri. So
okay,
I think
that is a big part of making this character who she is. Not only racism on the human level, black and white.
I was thinking more of there would be level. A different word. This is a hybrid. This is a hybrid. This is a person who has a foot in both worlds, a human world and the vampire world.
100%. Right. But the fact of her darker skin and the fact that she is subjected to really unfortunate racial terms because of her darker skin, I think you do have to bring in.
They never called her a muggle.
She is a mudblood for sure. Are we going to bring all the Harry Potter into this?
As we reach the ending of this novel, Butler was obviously setting it up to write more novels in this series. And she had started to do notes, but nothing more. So that's one of the things that, as I was saying earlier, the idea that both the Parable series, she wrote Parable of the Talents and Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Trickster, she had detailed notes for, which you can see at the Huntington Library. But for the Fledgling, she obviously sets up the epilogue for book two.
Mm-hmm. As all good science fiction, you know, eventually goes to, there's going to be a trade war. And
we avoided that, thankfully. You could see the setup for a trade war, though, right?
100%, you guys. Yeah, I know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's going to be a trade war. You never know. They may have to send the Jedi in to kind of, you know, figure out what's going on in Naboo.
It is sad that we lost this author in the middle of this story. This is just the opening salvo of what could have been a wonderful series. And I read an article where she said, this might be what I write for the rest of my life. And she was right.
Oh, sorry.
You never know. Jar Jar Binks could come in, and then then you have the prequels.
All the prequels.
Oh,
that would be.
Oh, yes. All the good stuff.
The good news is that this is being hopefully made into a wonderful, sweeping, epic television show. HBO gave the pilot order in July of 2021. This is just recent that HBO has taken on this story. Issa Rae and J.J. Abrams are executive producing. So I have high expectations for what a visual representation of this story could be.
At least there'll be lens flares.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this too. And I feel like Butler has such a strong and growing following among literary scholars. So certainly she's been getting increasing attention over the years. And I've just been waiting for her to come to TV or film. So I'm really excited about this.
Is this her first work that's been developed for, you know, other media?
Like, yeah, everything's been picked up. Everything's been optioned, but I don't believe anything has actually come out.
That's so too bad. I mean,
someone has the rights to Xenogenesis. Someone else has the rights to Parable, to all of her, to all of her works. Kindred, which is her first novel from 1977, has been optioned a couple of times, but I don't think has actually resulted in a film or TV series. And that, and they all should.
Well, I was going to say, if there was a time to release this, this would be the type of movie or series, you know, Pride Month. I mean, certainly she is, this is such a unique book in the sense that it's not, it's not always about sexuality in it, but there's just, these are people who live a true different lifestyle, and if you wanted to look at the rainbow flag, this would certainly be representing probably every part of that.
How many people that are vampires are walking around and don't have representation? Absolutely. This book does all the representation for it, for so many different things, from the racism, the black,
I'm thinking girl, more along the line, pansexuality, multiple partners,
it's all
polyamorous. There's a lot to unpack, and certain could lead to a lot of discussions. And most, not all books would be this accessible to the general reader.
Absolutely.
And certainly science fiction is a great place to place it. And the vampire book certainly feels like it would be very interesting. So there would be a lot of interesting discussions that could come from a series or a book, I mean, a movie or something of that nature of this level.
And I think Pam's had a lot of those conversations in class. I think this book does open up so many questions, so many great metaphors for our life and those decisions and the honoring of the people, regardless of their choices. Who are we is certainly on display in this book.
And as you might imagine, this is one of the novels that I've taught many times, and it never gets old for me, at least. I feel like every set of students takes something different out of it and focuses on something else. There's always just there. It's such a rich text. And I think the fact that it feels so accessible as you're reading it, you just flip through the pages, bam, 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 what happens next? And then it's so rereadable because there's so much depth, even though the surface feels kind of simple. Wow. So it's one of those books.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for bringing this to us. This is something that I can see a reread on this. I can see rethinking these issues. We didn't even get to my thing that I wanted to talk about, was choosing your family, was making those decisions. Who am I and who are these people that I choose to be a part of my community, my family? That's in there. There's so much to this. You're absolutely right. So that's Fledgling by Octavia E. Butler. It was published in 2005. I look forward to our next story that we get to talk with Pam about.
Thank you so much for reading this with me. As always, I learned so much from you guys as we talked about this. Thank you.
Perspective.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. There's a little bit of sci-fi news coming your way, Chip. Woo!
Well, Zuckerberg's gone meta, Steve.
Yes, he has. Good luck. Good luck Googling the word meta for the next decade.
Oh my gosh.
Well, it's not like Alphabet didn't set the precedent, Steve.
Everybody's favorite company, Alphabet. I told my students about...
It's a Google company. I'm sorry, it's the other way around, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Facebook announced this week that they are changing their corporate name to Meta. That is the name of the corporation that Facebook is now a part of, as opposed to the other way around.
Well, that's just part of their business, Steve.
Because what Mark Zuckerberg sees as the future of technology is this metaverse, this idea that your virtual life, your life in the digital world, can be separate from your meat life. And that's a dystopia that I've read a lot of times, Pam.
Yes, indeed. I must admit, I didn't quite know what to make of this news.
Well, tell me, do you know the name of Philip Morris? His parent company?
Is it smoking is good?
No, but anyway, that's a good point. That's how, that's why companies changed their name. Mm-hmm. So Steve, with dystopia and Zuckerberg on the docket, we should probably ask Pam if there's a way we could write about it.
Well, my friends, NaNoWriMo started yesterday, National Novel Writing Month, the month of November. Over 300,000 people commit to write 50,000 creative words in November. I am, of course, one of those crazy people who will do my very best. So join me.
It's a wonderful program. It's a wonderful way to actually get the writing down on paper. So many of us say we want to write, but getting the motivation to put pencil to paper or fingers to keyboard, it's 2021, I guess. But the actual community of people pushing you to actually put those words down on paper is a wonderful, wonderful way to do it.
And NaNoWriMo provides lots of like writing experiences locally and through the sort of big website, like writing sprints and writing challenges and, you know, writing buddies. So I've actually made friends over the years in NaNoWriMo that I've never met in real life, but that I always talk to about writing because it's so fun.
Building that community. And you're part of the New York City Midnight Short Story Challenge too, right?
That has been a lot of fun. So that's the contest where they give you three prompts and you have to put together a story in 24 or 48 hours. So I've been having a lot of fun with that too.
And a lot of success. You've gone on to the next round with your wonderful short story talking about aliens. Is that what I heard?
It's always about aliens, Steve. It's always about aliens.
It's about aliens.
An alien on a Tinder date, an alien at a coffee bean exposition. Because they tell you what you have to write about. So anyway, yeah, that's fun too.
We're so proud of you, Pam. You are so amazing. Thank you. Thank you for bringing the intelligence to too much scrolling. Thank you for bringing us Octavia Butler and all of your short story writing and NaNoWriMo. No, Pam, I am not going to join you in NaNoWriMo this year again.
But one day.
One day I should. That's where I get hooked up, is the one day. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam? You coming back for a third week in a row next week?
I'm going to let you guys get back to your business, but I'll see you soon.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you to everybody who's listening. Thank you to paying attention a little bit to a little bit of a meta thought, a metaverse of things with sweatshirts. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube, and you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm candidate number two. Vote for me.
And I'm Pam Bedore, supposedly candidate number two.
We'll see you in the future.